Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13. If you got away with a crime, how would you feel? Long-term guilt? Perhaps a sense of shame? Or maybe quite the opposite? You might feel true empowerment, that you had altered the world in some way. For those with a stronger grip on morality, shame would win out over time. But that was not the case for Donald Henry Gaskins, also known by his childhood nickname, Pee-wee. Since he was 11 years old, Gaskins was a criminal. He committed his first rape at that age, and his first attempted murder a few years later. He spent the next 30 or so years in and out of prison. He made all of his money working in chop shops, dismantling stolen vehicles and selling them for a profit. Gaskins also married many women and abandoned every one of them. He killed a man in prison just to make a name for himself. When we last left him, Pee-wee had just taken his first innocent life outside the walls of prison along the coastal highways of South Carolina. This marked the beginning of his career as a serial killer. It was the culmination of 35 years of physical abuse and mental deterioration as Gaskins was shuttled in and out of prison. And what was the most important lesson he learned? Dominance was the key. The first coastal kill was far from the last. In 1968 to 1975, Gaskins would continue acts of sexual depravity and murder. He was absolutely relentless. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and welcome to Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of some of the most infamous and notorious murderers. This is part two in our series chronicling the crimes and kills of Donald Henry Gaskins. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com. Spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. Now let's welcome back my co-host, Vanessa. As our serial killer expert, Vanessa will be providing insight into the psychology of Gaskins and how it relates to other serial killers in general. She's not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist herself, but she has done a lot of research on this subject.
In last week's episode, we discussed the childhood trauma and prison experiences that led to the creation of the serial killer inside Pee-wee Gaskins. Today, we'll focus more on what we know about Gaskins' plentitude of neuroses, including his hatred of women and fear of powerlessness. We can then use that information to track the psychological motivations of his worst crimes.
So let's head back to the end of the 1960s. Gaskins had just washed the blood of his first coastal kill off his hands, but he was already thirsting for more. Once again, sourced from the pages of Gaskins' own memoir, he can tell us in his own words about the workings of his mind.
After that first one on the road, I took to calling these my coastal kills. Something just felt right with that label. These were the ones where I didn't know the victims or their names or nothing about them, really.
In other words, this was recreational murder. The highways of South Carolina would be Pee-wee's killing fields for years to come. By Christmas 1969, Gaskins had killed three more random hitchhikers using just this method. With knowledge of the hidden old service roads, he developed a couple of burial grounds around the area. When he didn't want to bury his victims, he'd just weigh the corpses down with stones or chains and drop them in the river. This was a risky move, though. So Gaskins usually stuck to burying his victims. But before that, Gaskins took to torturing them for hours, engaging in horrific acts of mutilation, and by his own account, even cannibalism. For Gaskins, it wasn't just the killing that soothed his bothersome nature. It was the enacting of great suffering.
I prefer them to last as long as possible.
As he later told it, Gaskins sometimes gained pleasure from these kills by cooking pieces of his victims' bodies over a simple fire. It's important to note that cannibalism never became a key ingredient to any of Gaskins' murders. It was only something he did in special cases, a way to, as he put it, make the kill last as long as humanly possible.
According to his memoir, starting in 1970, Gaskins began averaging a coastal kill every 4 to 6 weeks.
Before, Gaskins tolerated his negative emotions as some sort of burden, but by this point, he had performed an act of mental magic, turning what was once a hindrance into fuel. It's like taking medication. He had self-prescribed a fix, unaware of the damage. It wasn't curing him, it was utterly destroying the last components of morality inside of him.
Gaskins would wait every month for his bothersome feelings to start to collect, build up, intensify, and then he would hit the road.
They're mostly just a jumble of faces and bodies and memories of things I did to them. The closest figure I can come up with is 80 to 90 people over those years. I finally reached the point where I wanted the bothersomeness to start. I looked forward to it every month because I felt so good relieving myself of it.
This is a clear sign of the development of a true compulsion. Desire became action. The action gave Gaskins a positive response. As is the nature of positive reinforcement, the feeling he received from killing stimulated him to continue committing the same acts over and over.
In 1971, Gaskins killed at least 11 more people. By 1975, he claimed to have truly lost track of the number of his so-called coastal kills. While we've taken into account the fact that he might be exaggerating for history's sake, there's no reason to doubt he took a significant number of lives during this 5-year period of anonymous killing.
Again, this ties directly back to Gaskins' struggle to grasp and maintain power. Like a sugar addict who devours candy in secret and buries the wrappers beneath the cushions of a couch, Gaskins decided to keep a side of himself secret, but very much alive. He actively began to foster a divide in his self, not a split personality, but a double life nonetheless.
Right. And the comfort of his consistent killing spree bled over into other areas of his life. For the first time, Gaskins was beginning to feel comfortable with the life he had made for himself. After 4 previous marriages we mentioned in part 1, all of which ended in abandonment instead of divorce, Gaskins settled down again in 1970. He had his second and last child, also named Donald. He then returned to his old favorite business, stealing cars, stripping them for parts, and repainting them to be sold again.
So at this point, Gaskins, in his mind, was crafting a new, stable life. On one side, he had a wife, child, and a thriving, if criminal, business. On the other, he prowled the roads as a vicious serial killer. He recognized both sides. There was no deluding himself. He was simply happy to have finally discovered the key to such a balance.
But such violence cannot be hidden away forever. The coastal killings might have been like vacations for Gaskins, but murder would soon follow him home. In order to chronicle the other half of his serial killer lifestyle, we're going to have to jump back in time to 1970, because as Gaskins continued to kill indiscriminately on South Carolina roads all through the early 70s, he also committed many murders closer to home.
Before 1970, I never gave any real serious thought whatsoever to killing somebody close to me. But the most important thing about 1970, well, that was the year I started doing my serious murders. The thing about these serious ones was that they required some real planning, both to get away with and, of course, who to kill.
With his new family in Sumter, Gaskins lived next door to his niece, Janice Kirby. Gaskins defined this as his first serious murder, because it was against a member of his own family. Gaskins discovered Janice and her friend Patricia Alsbrook out drinking late one night. He offered them a ride home. Instead, they ended up in an abandoned house where he tried to proposition them. When they inevitably turned him down, things got violent. The girls tried to fight back, striking Gaskins with a plank of wood.
Oh, God.
This only made it worse. Gaskins drew a gun on them. He proceeded to beat them with it until they fell unconscious. After violating them both, he followed a common procedure of disposal he utilized with some of his coastal kills. He drowned them and buried them in separate locations.
This only contributed to the growth of his megalomaniacal ego. Power feeds ego, and its desire soon turns insatiable. Like any classic megalomaniacal figure, be it someone like Hitler from human history or Captain Ahab from literature, the pursuit of power becomes the definition of power itself. There is no end game, there is only the endless game. Now that Pee-wee had succeeded in exercising the power from his coastal kills in his reality back home, there was no doubt in his mind that he would do it again.
And he would keep getting the chance to do it. Around 1971, another such occasion rose. Martha Dix was a local who sometimes went by the name of Clyde. While in today's world, Dix would have been recognized as a transgender man, he was a social pariah at the time. Another reason Dix was drawn toward Gaskins. They struck up a friendship, although it was probably one-sided. History is unclear about the actual status of their relationship. One thing we know for certain is that Dix was often found talking up the relationship around town, including the fact that Dix might have been carrying an illegitimate child fathered by Gaskins. This, of course, did not go over well for Pee-wee.
While there's not a lot of documentation to go off of, the fact that Dix was most likely transgender sheds some light on the situation. While Gaskins may have nurtured some sort of relationship there, the lack of acceptance toward transgender people during that time would have been a mark on Gaskins' dominance chart. He wanted to retain the image of being a man's man, and he certainly didn't want his wife thinking he had fathered a child with someone else. That would threaten both his domestic life and the secret life of serial killing he developed on the side.
So one night after work, Gaskins invited Dix to share a drink with him. Instead, he force-fed Dix a large dose of pills. It's unclear what type of pharmaceuticals were used, and the body was never found. However, the work was done, and Gaskins had committed the third of what he called his serious murders in his memoir. For reasons unknown, Gaskins moved his family to Charleston, South Carolina in 1971. By 1972, he had gotten involved in gun smuggling and sold to buyers Eddie and Bertie Brown. But when Gaskins thought they might be part of a police setup, his paranoia got the best of him. He decided to go on the offensive. He lured Eddie and Bertie out into the woods, and he shot them. Their bodies were buried in the same place he put Janice Kirby. By meddling in the criminal world of Charleston, Gaskins made some enemies. By 1973, his home in Charleston burned to the ground. Gaskins blamed random arsonists, but the actual cause was probably an act of retribution from a rival smuggler in the city.
Paranoia was beginning to hang on Gaskins, but he decided the best way to escape it was to keep moving, like the shark he was.
Hoping to find a final South Carolina home, the Gaskins clan settled for good in the town of Prospect. During the year of 73, while setting up yet another auto theft business in town, Gaskins killed another three people. One of these victims was Jackie Freeman. A 14-year-old runaway, Jackie fit the bill for Gaskins. However, in this case, Gaskins legitimately kidnapped her. It wasn't a quick and easy kill. In an undisclosed location, he held her for 2 days. The torture was more extensive than usual. According to his memoir, they developed a rapport, engaging in real conversation.
Such a claim should, of course, be taken with a grain of salt. While Jackie Freeman may have indeed engaged Gaskins in conversation, we can assume it was a survival instinct, not any sort of real human connection that Gaskins might have imagined. Freeman should be applauded for her brave attempt. In the past, victims have described using similar techniques to escape death from their would-be captors. Forming some sort of emotional bond with them, they allow themselves to be elevated to a higher level of humanity in the killer's eyes. Where before the killer would only see them as an object, they now become a more complex piece of their attacker's life. It can be just enough to open a hidden vent of empathy within their would-be killers, just enough to save their lives.
I always thought of Jackie as special. Not really a serious murder, but not just another coastal kill.
Unfortunately for Jackie, Gaskin's murderous personality had won the tug of war within his soul years ago. There was no longer a human side to appeal to. After 2 days of torture, Gaskins killed Jackie all the same. This marks a defining point in Gaskin's development as a killer and how he chose his victims in these later years of his life. While he may have continued to distinguish between what he deemed as coastal and serious killings, in reality there was little difference anymore. The coastal killings were merely easier to get away with, but now he believed he had the power and ability to take the life of any man, woman, or child.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network.
And now let's continue the story.
By 1974, Gaskins had settled into an easy routine in Prospect. He ran his chop shop business on one end and committed his killings on the other. While no one around town knew exactly what type of trouble he was, people certainly understood he was not a man to be trifled with.
Much like in prison, Gaskins worked and achieved victory in building a position at the top of the dominance hierarchy in this small community. Once a power man, always a power man.
In a particularly colorful event during this time, Gaskins purchased a hearse that he would regularly drive around town. Painted on the side?
"We haul anything, living or dead."
No one really wanted to question Gaskins. That's where his real power lay. No one was sure just how crazy the guy was, and no one really wanted to find out. Unfortunately, this meant that Gaskins went right on killing. And possibly his worst crime of all was one of the last murders he performed in 1974. Next door to the Gaskins lived Doreen Dempsey. 23 years old, Doreen was a single mother, pregnant with a second child. After the father abandoned her, Doreen decided to take her 2-year-old daughter Robin and leave town. As luck would have it, her friendly neighbor Pee-wee was willing to give her a ride to the bus station.
We know where this leads already.
Mm-hmm.
They turned down the wrong road. Doreen began to get nervous.
Please be advised that the following sequence involves situations of sexual abuse and rape. What you're about to hear is disturbing and intended for mature audiences only. Gaskins drove Doreen and Robin into the middle of the woods. Doreen begged Gaskins to let 2-year-old Robin go. She would do anything. So Gaskins forced Doreen to have sex with him to assure her daughter's safety. But he lied. Gaskins did unspeakable things to Doreen and Robin. After his rape of Doreen, he struck her over the head with a hammer, killing her. He had his way with Robin afterward, and then strangled her to death. Mother and daughter were buried in the same grave, deep in the backwoods of South Carolina.
At this point in American history, especially in a place like South Carolina, an unmarried woman with an illegitimate child was not to be trusted. She had no earned place in society, and that's what hid Gaskins so well for so long.
Gaskins seamlessly returned to his own home. No one thought he could be connected to Doreen's disappearance. She must have simply fled town out of shame for her own sins. Gaskins was a family man. He might have been a criminal, but he never hurt anyone who didn't deserve it, right? By this point, he was a father to 3-year-old Donald Jr. and a known figure around town.
Despite his dangerous aura, he appeared like a Southern family man and was valued for it. It seemed there was a double standard when it came to how men and women were perceived in this town. Sadly, Doreen was looked down upon. But Gaskins had a place to call home, and he was given inherent trust. Trust he continued to abuse again and again.
"Of course I remember Doreen, and little Robin, too. The best kills of my life."
We've made it back through all the coastal and serial murders to 1975. This year would reveal itself to be the pivotal year in Donald Henry Gaskins' life. Or as he would phrase it,
"I would call it my busiest year and my killingest year of them all."
There's no real way to verify this statement, as Gaskins purposely obscured the true amount of lives he claimed over the years. Yet, if we go off his confirmed murders, this is very much a fact. This was also the year when his house of cards would collapse on itself. This cataclysm started quietly, with what Gaskins thought of as a simple slaying. Three traveling hippies on the road to Georgetown. Their van broke down, and ever the car expert, Gaskins pulled over to investigate. Instead of helping them, he made sure their journey immediately came to an end. While there isn't any information on how he killed them, we do know that he disposed of the bodies himself. The van, however, was another matter. He needed help. So he called on his simple-minded friend and loyal lackey, Walter Neely. Walter was Gaskins' closest friend in town. Either out of fear or ignorance, Walter assisted Gaskins in covering up this triple homicide.
Gaskins was a master of the dominance hierarchy by now. He believed he had Walter pegged, a submissive, someone too frightened to ever turn against him. Pee-wee was no fool. He was good at reading people now, detecting their threat levels. And he was right in this instance. Walter wouldn't dare to tell anyone about this little escapade. Plus, Gaskins hadn't revealed any evidence of actual violence, just the empty van and an arrogant story about how he had dealt with some hippies on the road.
Meanwhile, the townspeople of Prospect started to realize that if you needed some dirty work done, Pee-wee Gaskins just might be the perfect man to turn to. And that's exactly what local Suzanne Kipper did. She was fed up with her ex, Silas Yates, and in love with John Owens. Owens and Kipper were enraged with Yates for taking back all sorts of expensive gifts from Suzanne after their fling ended. All it took was $1,500. Pee-wee readily agreed to the deal. A new business venture had just taken form before his eyes. A new destiny, really. As an assassin.
Gaskins enjoyed being this devious. This was not one of his regular killings. In his eyes, this was a full-fledged adventure in its own right. He recruited Walter Neely's ex-wife, Diane, to do the legwork, luring Silas Yates out of his house the night of February 12th.
Out in the woods, Gaskins and Owens were waiting. Gaskins shot Yates dead, and the two men buried him. Kipper ended up marrying Owens, but revenge cost her. For the rest of the year, Gaskins would blackmail her into sex, over and over. She had sold her soul to the devil without even knowing it. Soon, though, blackmail would come back to bite him. Diane Neely aligned herself with Gaskins' old prison buddy, Avery Howard, and decided to extort him for their knowledge of the Yates slaying.
Ah, don't be a little girl, Avery. We can get that smug jackass right now.
Pee-wee ain't right in the head. He's not the best guy to mess around with. You seen that hearse he drives around town?
He's all talk, believe me. Needed my help in killing Yates. The only person really scared of him is my idiot ex-husband.
So that's exactly what they did. Diane and Avery contacted Gaskins, told him they would rat him out unless he forked over $5,000 and arranged a meetup. But there was a major flaw in their plan. They met Gaskins in one of his favorite places, the middle of the woods.
You're getting brave, Diane.
Hey, Pee-wee, you know Prospect. We're a bunch of liars and scammers all, ain't we?
Avery, you really going to do me like this? After what we've been through in the pen?
Just come out of the shadows, Gaskins. Let's finish this.
Sure will. Oh. Looks like your lady's a goner, Avery. Too bad.
Pee-wee, please.
Another two murders successfully hidden. But his next two crimes would prove to be the biggest mistakes of his life.
In his lack of caution, Gaskins differs from more successful serial killers in a key way. My best hypothesis in this case points toward the overall quality of his life outside of killing. Unlike other killers like Jeffrey Dahmer, whose periods of serial killing stretched over decades, Gaskins barely made it 7 years. Bundy and Dahmer were both charming and outwardly caring people. Bundy served as an operator on a suicide hotline. Dahmer was an active proponent of gay rights. They held a status in public perspective that kept them safe from the same ego troubles that haunted Pee-wee all his life. Without the killing, Gaskins was just a good-for-nothing father and a car thief. All of the true power he felt within himself came from his ability to take life from other people. Much like Charles Manson, Gaskins' decrepit life would totally fall apart if he wasn't allowed to wield power over others. But after so many kills, it was only a matter of time before the trail of blood would lead authorities to Gaskins.
In Pee-wee's neighborhood in Prospect, there lived a 13-year-old girl named Kim Gelkins.
Young women were a fixation for Gaskins. We can see it easily enough in his desire for both niece Janice Kirby and hitchhiker Jackie Freeman. While he killed women of all ages, a thread of pedophilia runs throughout his entire history of assault. This can be traced back to his own youth and the sexual abuse he experienced. Such trauma might have frozen something inside of Gaskins, trapping his sexual desire in a juvenile, underdeveloped stage. Perhaps he was trying to reclaim some of the power he lost at Kim's age. Perhaps it was normalized in his mind. Perhaps the taboo itself appealed to his dangerous and risk-taking personality. Whatever the reasoning was in his mind, when someone like Kim came along, Gaskins couldn't resist.
Kim Gelkins often spent time out of her own home, though the reasons are unknown. Gaskins took advantage of this vulnerability. He claimed to have formed a friendship with the young girl, or at least that's what Kim Gelkins must have thought was happening.
It's telling that with Janice, Jackie, and Kim, Gaskins claimed to have developed some sort of real relationship with each of them. It's as if he wanted to be a part of their lives, but his mind wouldn't let him reconcile the difference between a father figure and a lover.
The results were as predictable as they were despicable. After Gaskins took Kim home one afternoon, she turned down his sexual advances. He turned on her, raped her, and murdered her. She received a burial ground in the woods, like many of his other victims.
They may have opened up to him as a father figure, but they had no desire to take him as a lover in any form. Emotionally an infant himself, Gaskins acted out his violent, conflicting desires on all of these young women.
This isn't the last we'll hear about Kim, but let's keep following Gaskins a few more weeks toward the end of 1975. Diane Neely, Walter's ex and the woman who tried to blackmail Gaskins, may have been just an afterthought to Pee-wee by now. But Diane's brother Dennis and his half-brother Johnny suspected Gaskins as the man responsible for her disappearance. One night, Dennis and Johnny broke into Gaskins' car shop and vandalized it. They didn't suspect Gaskins to be waiting for them.
This is the second time people have tried to get the upper hand on Gaskins, yet his instincts were finely tuned. He always seemed to be one step ahead. A life of murder leads right into a life of paranoia, and Gaskins used these extrasensory abilities well.
Gaskins killed both Dennis and Johnny on the spot, but Gaskins needed someone to help him clean up the mess and cover his tracks. That person was the rather uneducated and weak-willed Walter Neely.
Here we go, Walter. Come on in.
By 1975, Gaskins had cultivated many graves across his home state. With the accumulation of such a horrible collection, his pride grew like a malignant tumor. Murder was Pee-wee Gaskins' choice of therapy, and for him, it worked wonders.
Pee-wee, I don't know about this. Maybe we should head back.
Don't go yellow now, Walter. I trust you. You can keep a secret, right? You've done it for me before. You're my friend. Maybe the only one I got in South Carolina.
That was the night Gaskins opened up to Walter, letting him in on his biggest secret. Walter helped Gaskins bury Dennis and Johnny in one of the burial spots Gaskins kept around the South Carolina woodland. Pee-wee bragged over his killings and pointed out various other spots where he had hidden bodies over the last 7 years.
Gaskins parted ways with Walter that night, confident that his secrets would be kept safe. Just business as usual, Gaskins knew he was the most dominant figure in Walter's life.
Meanwhile, an unexpected event caught Gaskins off guard. Unlike many of his victims, there was still people looking out for Kim Gelkins, the teenager Gaskins had recently killed. Prime among them were her parents. They never liked Gaskins' creepy affection for their daughter and pointed police in his direction. They searched his house and found some of Kim's clothes hidden away in a closet. This wasn't enough to prove he killed her, but it was enough to indict Gaskins on a real charge, assisting in the delinquency of a minor. They threw him in jail for 3 weeks. Still, Gaskins felt secure. There was no way they would ever find Kim's body. When Pee-wee wanted someone to go away, they went away for good. He spent the 3 weeks relaxed, assured of his safety. But unbeknownst to him, the police were working on a second angle at the same time.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message. And now, back to serial killers.
It turns out in the case of Walter Neely, someone did trump Gaskins on the dominance hierarchy. God. The guilt of what he had discovered hung heavily over Walter's head. He ended up in a confession booth at a local church. The priest promised to keep his secrets, but urged Walter to cleanse himself of sin and confess to the real authorities. So that's exactly what Walter Neely did. While Gaskins waited out his term in jail, Walter took the police to the burial site where Dennis, Johnny, and a few others were 6 feet under. On December 10th, after already finding 6 bodies, Walter led police to the most horrific site of them all. The hole where once pregnant Doreen Dempsey laid with her toddler daughter, Robin. The serial killer called Pee-wee Gaskins had been caught. And there was no escaping from this. Not anymore.
Coroner had the bodies. Jesus had Walter. And the law had me.
On May 28, 1976, Gaskins was sentenced to die. This was in a trial specifically centered around the murders of Dennis Bellamy and Johnny Knight. The other bodies discovered were merely icing on the prosecution's cake. In order to take down Gaskins apart from Walter Neely, the two co-conspirators were given separate trials, where Gaskins received death as punishment. Neely received a single life sentence. Neely's lawyers achieved this by painting his psychology as one of a weak-willed, intellectually hobbled man, drawn into the darkness by master manipulator Gaskins.
In a way, I reckon that was true, too. Walter surely weren't real bright, and he did pretty much anything I asked him, up until he got born again and forgot all about what loyalty and friendship meant.
Gaskins' relationship with Walter Neely stands out as a huge failure in his life. Driven onward by his increasingly deranged personality, the domination and subjugation of another man as both an accomplice and servant was surely pleasing to Gaskins' ego. He wanted to prove to himself once and for all that he truly could control anyone. Again, parallels can be drawn to Charles Manson here. He and Gaskins' ultimate downfall came about because the power they believed they wielded truly wasn't as strong as they thought, not in the face of the law, and not even in the face of a higher power. Gaskins may have despised the notion of a religious god, but it was the institution and the institutional guilt associated with religion that brought him down.
While he would never again see the outside world, Gaskins did manage to luck out. Because in November 1976, the South Carolina death penalty statute was invalidated by the federal government. It would have to move through a revision period before Gaskins could be sentenced again. This did not stop the charges from stacking up, though. The murder of Silas Yates was charged to Gaskins, as even more buried bodies were dug up. Backed into a legal corner, Gaskins even gave up another one of his grave sites for the authorities. Such a trail of blood generated a lot of press for Gaskins.
In prison, I was the boss hog. I was downright famous.
Even at his lowest point, Gaskins clung to the last position of power left to him. Outside, to the country at large, Gaskins officially became known as the most prolific serial killer in South Carolina history. By the year 1980, the death penalty statute was back in position. While Gaskins was on death row, he was also caught in legal limbo, suspended animation before execution. While the state juggled his fate in their legal hands, he took up work as a technician in the South Carolina death row facilities. This brought him into close contact with many of the other doomed people in solitary cells. One of those people was Rudolph Tyner, an African-American man convicted of the double homicide of Bill and Myrtle Moon. Tyner hoped to draw out his case using an accusation of racial injustice, in hopes of living long enough to reach another suspension of the death statute. Tony Simo, the son of Myrtle Moon, refused to allow this to happen, so he passed a message through the network of prisoners in the facility, a plea to Pee-wee Gaskins.
I would not be writing this if justice was not what I sought. As can be seen in your own case, the court system is hobbled. The righteous can be punished, and the damned can be spared. I write you asking for assistance. I write to you with a request. Kill Rudolph Tyner. Do the state's job for them. You'll be rightly awarded for this duty. Destroy this message after reading it. I'll be in contact again shortly.
Well, ain't that exciting?
The opportunity was too good to pass up. Behind bars, the bothersomeness had returned in full force. It must have been like withdrawal for someone so dependent on the act of killing.
Gaskins accepted Simo's offer with glee. The first step was bonding with Rudolf Tyner. As a maintenance worker, Gaskins often had free rein to communicate with Tyner through the vents in the solitary cells. Simo, using the hollowed-out heels of his cowboy boots, would sneak in things for Gaskins to use against Tyner. First, it was poison. Tyner was an addict, so Gaskins would gift him with marijuana, heroin, or just sweet snacks, all dosed with poison. Tyner became violently ill and had chronic stomach struggles all year, but he did not perish. All that happened was that Tyner began to see Gaskins as a friend, the only one who would stand beside him in times of hardship.
One could almost read a revenge scenario into Gaskins' acceptance of this final hit job. After the betrayal of Walter Neely, perhaps Gaskins took this opportunity to strike back at the concept of loyalty and friendship itself. This might be his last chance to take a life. He was going to do everything he could to be satisfied by it, like a cat playing with a mouse before it strikes.
Gaskins suggested a new plan to Simo. Ferried into prison once again in the hollowed-out core of his cowboy boots, Simo made a more sensitive delivery to his hired hand. A small amount of plastic explosive C4. Like two young neighborhood friends, Gaskins pitched Tyner the idea of threading a communication relay through the vents between their two cells, utilizing, and we kid you not, two plastic cups and a string.
Testing? Testing?
They set a date. On September 12, 1982, Gaskins would make the inaugural call on their communication device. You see, like some kind of devious MacGyver, Gaskins had loaded Tyner's end of the cup relay with plastic explosives. When Tyner raised the cup to his ear, hoping to hear the voice of a friend, Tyner instead got a face full of C4, thanks to Gaskins' remote detonator. With a bang, Gaskins made the final kill of his life.
The last thing he heard through that speaker cup before it blew off his head was me, laughing.
His partner in crime, Tony Simo, proved to be as unreliable as Walter Neely. Not that Gaskins hid the evidence all that well. At this point, there was no reason to. Everyone knew that there was only one person on death row with the know-how and deviousness to pull something off like this. Gaskins was indicted on conspiracy and murder charges and received 3 years in solitary confinement. In 1986, South Carolina's electric chair was moved to Broad River Correctional, outside of Columbia. Gaskins went with it, returning to the first city where he was incarcerated.
All these years later, Gaskins' circle of violence finally came to a close.
He whiled away his time waiting for the state to give the final orders. In 1993, Gaskins met with Wilton Earle to record his memoir, Final Truth, excerpts of which have been played throughout our two episodes. He didn't know it yet, but these were the final months of his life.
I truly don't mind dying. I've lived a damn full and good life. I have walked the same path as God. By taking lives and making others afraid, I became God's equal. Through killing others, I became my own master. Through my own power, I come to my own redemption. When they put me to death, I'll die remembering the freedom and pleasure of my life. I'll die knowing that there are others coming along to take my place. And that most of them won't never get caught.
Strong words for a man in such a position. In these last years, Gaskins seemed to adopt a rather fatalistic outlook on life. The world he lived in was not the world most of us inhabit. It was a place ruled by desire and shaped completely by power. For a man who hated God his whole life, Gaskins sure seemed to find the omnipotent figure a role model. Like some sort of twisted New Age guru, Pee-wee's self-help was a selfish and twisted mantra.
Through killing others, I became my own master. Through my own power, I came to my own redemption.
these words seemed too rehearsed to be natural or off the cuff. In his final will and testament, Gaskins hoped to immortalize himself. His final lines are the most telling. He hopes there will be others like him who find power the way he did. While it may seem to be a terrifying thing to say, and it does contain some truth, knowing what we do about killers like Manson and many others that came after Gaskins, in the end, I see these words as a desperate cry of loneliness. Here's a man who shut himself inside a cage his entire life. He never knew true friendship and never knew true love. All he could hope for in the end was that he was not the only one to have been damaged to this degree. His worldview was so distorted that he believed killers were some sort of underprivileged minority whose days in the sun would someday come. These words seem to me to be a final grasp for freedom and show us that Gaskins remained blinded to the truth of the world until the day he died.
And despite his brave face, Pee-wee did fear death in the end. His final repeal was rejected in June 1991. Trying to stave off the electric chair, Gaskins slashed his wrists, non-lethally, to force officials to hospitalize him. But the state of South Carolina was done with Donald Henry Gaskins. Its prison system had had more than enough for one lifetime. Instead of hospitalization, prison doctors patched his wounds with stitches and wheeled him to the electric chair with bandaged arms, just in time to meet his date with destiny at 1:05 a.m., September 6, 1991. After 58 years of life and anywhere between 10 and 200 victims, Pee-wee Gaskins left this world looking not much like a god at all. Thank you for joining us over the last 2 weeks as we trace the life of Pee-wee Gaskins, the most notorious serial killer in South Carolina history.
It's sad to see how all of his terrible actions were driven by such a simplistic distortion of perspective. Once a killer decides to let the monster inside, it's difficult to keep it from taking over.
Be sure and join us next Monday when we look into the mind of the Zodiac Killer. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network. And as always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Jack Bentel and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Kinna McEnroe, Hunter Peterson, and Steve Pinto.